Donald Trump says the U.S. to redevelop Gaza.
The U.S. will take over the Gaza Strip, and we will do a job with it, too. We'll own it.
VOA meets with refugees of the Sudanese civil war.
Practically everybody here at the refugee site in Adre has got a horrific story to tell.
And Guantanamo Bay is once again the center of controversy.
According to the administration, we could see tens of thousands of these migrants arriving in Guantanamo in the coming days and weeks.
Today is Wednesday, February 5th, and this is VOA's International Edition.
I'm Steve Karish.
And I'm Alexis Strobe. President Donald Trump met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu at the White House late Tuesday afternoon. The talks come at an important point in the ceasefire deal between Israel and Hamas. There are less than 4 weeks to agree on the terms of the second phase, which would include the release of all remaining hostages held in Gaza, a permanent halt in fighting, and Israel's withdrawal from the territory. Trump also said on Tuesday, before meeting with Netanyahu, that the 3 to 5 year reconstruction plan as called for in the ceasefire deal is not viable. He proposed finding someplace else for the Palestinians to go to build them some really nice places and said that would be better than going back to Gaza. Gaza, Trump said, is a hellhole that needs to be totally rebuilt. And for that to happen, all the people need to be relocated.
Following the meeting, Netanyahu and Trump stood side by side at a press conference. President Trump said the U.S. would take over the Gaza Strip to rebuild and develop it. Speaking to reporters, Trump said, "I do see a long-term ownership position, and I see it bringing great stability to that part of the Middle East."
The U.S. will take over the Gaza Strip, and we will do a job with it, too. We'll own it and be responsible for dismantling all of the dangerous unexploded bombs and other weapons on the site. Level the site and get rid of the destroyed buildings, level it out, create an economic development that will supply unlimited numbers of jobs and housing for the people of the area.
When pressed, he said the U.S. will own it, and when asked, he did not rule out using the U.S. military to secure it. Separately, Trump signed an executive order putting maximum pressure on Iran just hours before meeting with Netanyahu. This follows Monday, when Trump submitted a plan to Congress to sell $1 billion worth of bombs and military equipment to Israel, the Wall Street Journal reported. For more, I'm joined by our White House bureau chief, Patsy Wita-Kuswara.
This is moving even beyond what President Trump himself has said. I mean, as we know, he has been hinting since January that he wants Gazans to relocate to neighboring Jordan and Egypt. But tonight, what he said was clearly he wants the U.S. to take over the Gaza Strip. He did say we'll own it. And then he did say that the Palestinians who are currently living in Gaza, the nearly 2 million people, should leave the territory and be placed in other countries in the Middle East. He didn't stop at Jordan or Egypt. He did say, you know, it could be 1, 2, 3, 4, whatever areas, whatever countries would accept them, describing it as a preferred alternative for Gazans. He described Gaza as, quote, a hellhole, as an unlucky place, and he seemed to say that, you know, the Palestinians really want to stay in Gaza because they don't have any other alternatives. He clearly described plans for the U.S. and using other wealthy nations' money to redevelop Gaza, calling it as a possible Riviera of the Middle East.
What was Prime Minister Netanyahu's reaction to all this? What did he say as the president said that the U.S. would take over that land and essentially run it?
Well, Netanyahu seems to be very supportive of the plan. I mean, clearly, if the Palestinians leave Gaza and Israel or the U.S. would annex the territory, that would be in line with the right-wing faction of his coalition has been pushing for. I mean, they are saying that Israel should annex Gaza and the West Bank. And so this is, again, like something that President Trump is also hinting when he was asked whether he has the same plans for Samaria.
Earlier, when President Trump suggested that the Palestinians go someplace else, not necessarily be sent someplace else. There was a lot of opposition from people in the Arab community, the Palestinian community, and in the Middle East and here in the United States. They see it as another attempt to get the Palestinians off of their land. During the day on Tuesday, was there any more similar statements as these ideas from Trump started to come?
Earlier today, in the Oval Office, when Trump was specifically asked whether the Saudis are demanding a Palestinian state, which is, you know, what they have publicly said they need in order to normalize relations with Israel, President Trump said very clearly that no, they are not. So there's a lot of interesting developments going on. Like, clearly we need a few more, we need more time to kind of do more reporting on what is true and what is not, what are the public positions versus the private positions of all the players. But nevertheless, what President Trump has said has been quite shocking to a lot of people, and I'm sure we'll get reactions from the region very quickly.
As if that wasn't enough, the president spoke about several things during this press conference. He also addressed the situation with Iran. And going into this meeting with Netanyahu, personally, I thought the story with Iran was going to be the top story coming out of it. Earlier today, he signed an executive order saying that the U.S. will place maximum pressure on Iran. And on Monday, the president asked Congress to approve a sale of $1 billion worth of military equipment to Israel. What's the situation with Iran? What's the latest? What did the two leaders have to say?
Well, ahead of his meeting with Netanyahu, President Trump did sign either an executive order or presidential memorandum. It's not clear because we haven't seen it from the White House as of today, Tuesday evening. But basically what he wants to do is to restore his maximum pressure campaign on Iran to prevent it from getting a nuclear weapon and to drive down its oil exports to zero. We don't know yet whether this is new sanctions, but we do know that President Trump has repeated that he is torn and he is unhappy about signing the memorandum that he said is very tough on Iran. And again, we don't know whether this is messaging or whether this is an actual new action that the administration will be taking on Tehran. But he did say that he did not have much choice in doing it because we have to be strong and firm against Tehran. And he did say that I hope that it's not going to have to be used in any great measure at all. But the bottom line, as he said, is that Iran cannot have a nuclear weapon.
Well, Patsy Wiedekuswara, VOA's White House Bureau Chief. Patsy, as you said, I think we need a little more time to digest and do some more reporting on this. Watch this space. Patsy, thanks for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Tragedy in Sweden on Tuesday as around 10 people were killed in the country's worst mass shooting. Jillian Kitchener of Reuters has the story.
Police were investigating the motive for a mass shooting at an adult education center in central Sweden on Tuesday, the country's deadliest attack ever. The local police chief said that, quote, 10 or so people were killed in the shooting, telling a news conference that he couldn't be more exact about the death toll at that time because, quote, the extent of the incident is so large. He also said the gunman is believed to be among those killed.
He is not known to the police from before and has no gang affiliations. What we believe is that it was a lone perpetrator. I want to emphasize that the situation could change, and this is the information we have at the moment.
A student at the school for adults told local TV news that she and her friend tried to stem the bleeding of one of the victims.
A guy next to me was shot in the shoulder. He was bleeding a lot. When I looked behind me, I saw three people on the floor bleeding. Everyone was shocked. They said, "Get out, get out." I and my friend tried to save the life of this person.
The search for victims went into the evening, as Swedish Prime Minister Ulf Kristersson spoke to reporters.
It is difficult to take in the magnitude of what has happened today, the darkness that is now falling over Sweden tonight. Today, we have seen a brutal, deadly violence against completely innocent people. This is the worst mass shooting in Swedish history.
Police said they had opened an investigation into murder, arson, and an aggravated weapons offense. The school in Örebro, Sweden, where the shooting took place, is for adults who did not complete their formal education or failed to get the grades to continue to higher education.
Jillian Kitchener of Reuters reporting for us.
And here are some more stories we're following from around the world.
The Trump administration is assessing whether it could take up El Salvador's offer to house U.S. citizens convicted of crimes in its jails, Secretary of State Marco Rubio said on Tuesday, despite the apparent illegality of such a move. On Monday, El Salvador's president, Nayib Bukele, offered the U.S. the opportunity to outsource part of its prison system, he said on X, after meeting with Rubio. Rubio called it an incredible offer. He added, however, that obviously we'll have to study it on our end. There are obviously legalities involved. We have a constitution, he said. The U.S. Constitution provides protections for citizens, and courts have ruled that Americans cannot be stripped of their citizenship for committing crimes, meaning they cannot be deported. Trump later said that he would enact the plan in a heartbeat if he had the legal right to do so, and that it would be cheaper than holding inmates in private U.S. prisons.
The rebel group M23 declared a ceasefire in areas under its control in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, citing humanitarian reasons. On Tuesday, the streets of Goma were busy as aid groups rushed to help the thousands of people wounded and displaced during last week's fighting between the M23 and the pro-Congolese government forces. Crispin Mvano, a political and security expert in Goma, told VOA that people there were going about their business peacefully. According to Mvano, residents in the city center reported seeing numerous trucks carrying petrol and other goods from Tanzania, Uganda, and Rwanda. Many people who fled the conflict were returning. The UN and the US consider the M23 a rebel group, while the DRC considers it a terrorist organization.
Trump's effort to ban federal funding for gender-affirming care for young people is facing a legal challenge. Individuals who say they have been denied care since he signed it last week filed a lawsuit in a federal court in Baltimore, Maryland on Tuesday. PFLAG, a national group for family and friends of LGBTQ+ people, and the Gay and Lesbian Medical Association, a doctor's organization, are also plaintiffs in the case. The order is one of several Trump has signed targeting transgender people during his first weeks back in office. Legal challenges have already been filed on the order banning transgender people from serving in the military and a plan to move transgender women in federal prisons to men's facilities.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Karish.
And I'm Alexis Strope. We look now at American policy and politics.
In Los Angeles, residents of fire-devastated areas are filing lawsuits against the city's electricity supplier. Some residents have videos they say shows that sparking power lines caused one of the most destructive fires. Angelina Bagdasarian visited the area and spoke with residents. Anna Rice narrates the story.
Altadena resident Fred Vanderlinde goes through the ashes that used to be his house as he searches for a statuette he had given his wife as a gift 30 years ago. When wildfires first came to this area on January 7th, Vanderlinde says he did what he could to save his home.
I was here till 3:45 in the morning with my little garden hose trying to put out embers. And then all of my palm trees exploded. And then it was just, the winds were probably 50, 60 miles an hour. And there was just no way I could fight it then.
The Eaton fire destroyed an estimated 5,700 hectares, resulting in 17 deaths and the loss of over 9,000 structures in and around the community of Altadena. Numerous lawsuits blame the fires on Southern California Edison, the region's electricity supplier. Locals took pictures and videos of a fire starting near electric poles in the mountains. Another video at an Altadena gas station shows power lines sparking before a tree catches on fire. David Eisenhower is a Southern California Edison spokesman.
We are fully cooperating with investigators and remain committed to a thorough and transparent process. That video requires very careful analysis, and it would be premature to discuss or speculate on a video before it has been analyzed by the experts.
Wildfires are part of life in California. State officials recorded over 8,000 fires just last year. But experts like Stephanie Pincel say humans cause most wildfires in California, not drought or strong winds.
Either they're throwing a cigarette out the window, or they don't have a good spark arrestor on their lawnmower, or there's a power line that goes down. they're barbecuing, they're lighting a fire, they're lighting fireworks. But most of the wildfires, so-called, in California are human-ignited.
While it's hard to fix the human problem, one obvious solution Wunderlinde points out is to put power lines underground. Princel says logistics and money make that extremely difficult.
A power line that extends over very, very flammable areas, that over very rugged terrain, that would be enormously expensive to underground. You have to go up and down mountains, very steep mountains, by the way, and would cost probably billions of dollars.
But if Edison's equipment is found to be responsible, and the investigation will take many months, the company will be on the hook for billions of dollars to cover the damages from some of the most destructive wildfires in U.S. history, which killed 29 people. For Angelina Bogdasarian in Los Angeles, California, NRIs, VOA News.
The U.S. naval base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, has been politically contentious since the U.S. started keeping suspected terrorists there following the attacks of September 11, 2001. The thinking at the time was that if suspected terrorists are not brought into the United States, they would not be subjected to American law and therefore could be detained longer and with fewer rights than prisoners in American jails.
Now, amid Trump's push towards mass deportations of illegal immigrants, the base is once again in the center of a political firestorm. Alexis spoke with our Pentagon correspondent, Carla Babb, for more.
So the big question right now is this move by the Trump administration to move migrants to Guantanamo Bay legal?
Well, my understanding is that there are lawyers at DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, and here at the Pentagon that are still trying to figure that out.
So as migrants are being moved, that answer has not been found yet.
Is still unknown to us at this time. We are still waiting to hear more details from officials. Here's what we do know. We know that there are fewer than 20 migrants. That's what I was told by one official. These migrants have been deemed as a high threat. They were transported because they are a high threat, and they are actually going to be staying at the detention facility in Guantanamo that also housed some of the 9/11 captives that occurred after 9/11 and when we went to war with Al-Qaeda. The issue that some people are trying to wrap their heads around is that that's not exactly where the Marines that have deployed to Guantanamo, that's not where they're at. They're trying to build out another facility which houses migrants. It was built to house migrants back in the 1990s. And so what the Marines are doing is they're trying to add tents and all sorts of resources, latrines, et cetera, to prepare for additional migrants. Not deemed to be a high threat, but just a place to house immigrants that have arrived in the U.S. illegally, that the U.S. wants to deport but doesn't have the ability to deport them at this time. So they're going to send them to Guantanamo first. According to the administration, we could see tens of thousands of these migrants arriving in Guantanamo in the coming days and weeks.
As far as legal options for migrants, is it different for them now that they'll be housed at Guantanamo Bay versus if they were held within the United States in a detention facility here?
That is not something that I know. So the Pentagon, somebody was telling me today, we just do the transportation. We are the transportation. We are not the the legal consults on this. So I'm not sure what changes in terms of legal access they'll have. I mean, clearly they'll be outside of the United States, which is what the administration wants. But I don't know what ramifications. Again, we need to find out if this is legal first before I think we can move forward on the additional questions.
Does the Pentagon see this as a long-term solution, as they're sort of caught in the middle of this, as a long-term solution to the mass deportation efforts? Or has the Trump administration talked about a backup plan if Guantanamo Bay is no longer an option?
So the Pentagon has not been given an end date. But, you know, it is unclear because, like you said, the question number one, the question that you started with, if this is not deemed to be legal, then this will have to stop. When it comes to the legality of DOD, what they're doing, they're transporting the migrants. DHS is the one that is actually detaining them. So based on some of the things that have happened in the past, you know, the flights that have gone to other places in Colombia or elsewhere, you know, if that is legal, the assumption is that a flight to Cuba would also be legal. The detention itself is what I think the lawyers are still trying to work out. So I think that we're trying to build an airplane that we're flying, so to speak. And so I think that the military is just cautiously carrying out orders that they deem that they're still trying to make sure are legal. And that's kind of where they are. But this is something that is a top priority for the administration. We knew that the border was going to be the first place that the president was looking at, that the Secretary of Defense, that's what he mentioned repeatedly in his hearing. He had said that repeatedly in his previous job as a host on Fox News. So this is their way of trying to take illegal immigration as seriously as possible. I mean, and it's not just this. Let's not forget that there are thousands of U.S. military service members deployed at the border right now assisting DHS with a lot of various aspects. I won't say with capturing migrants, because there is a law in the United States where they cannot actually conduct law enforcement activities. So the military right now is trying to assist in other ways, building barriers, helping with surveillance, et cetera, et cetera. Now, there is an exception. There are actually multiple exceptions. The most notable one is the Insurrection Act that the president could invoke, which could change that and could give the military the opportunity to help conduct law enforcement activities on U.S. soil. That has not happened yet.
VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb, thank you very much for your insight today.
You're welcome.
On Chad's border with Darfur, VOA met with refugees who have told harrowing stories of what the United States has described as acts of genocide in Sudan, allegedly by the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, or RSF.
As the refugees call for action, the United States has imposed sanctions on leaders of the RSF and associated militias. Henry Wilkins reports from Adre, Chad.
Noor al-Latif is a refugee who, like hundreds of thousands of others, fled to Chad from Sudan's Darfur region to escape ethnic violence over the last 2 years. She is also a trained psychologist and now spends her days in the refugee camp on the Chad-Darfur border, giving psychological support to victims.
The psychological trauma is overwhelming. The loss of loved ones is immense. Death has become too frequent. Some families have lost both parents. In such cases, the child becomes the caretaker.
Al-Latif says she works with a 14-year-old girl who became head of the family after both parents were killed. VOA spent more than a week in the refugee camp in Adre speaking to victims.
Practically everybody here at the refugee site in Adre has got a horrific story to tell about friends, family members, neighbours being murdered in what the US has called a genocide.
And the US says other crimes against humanity are also taking place. The name of this refugee has been changed and her identity protected for fear of reprisals if she returns to Darfur.
They killed my mother and my brother. They killed them in my house. They killed a lot of people.
She says she was then raped by militias linked to the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, or RSF. Mohammed Idris Adam, a well-known artist in the Darfuri city of El Janina, says he was on an RSF hit list. He fled the city but left everything he owned, including his life's work, behind.
The whole world condemns violations of human rights, and they have agreements under the United Nations and so on. The people responsible should be brought to trial for the crimes committed in Darfur.
The US has sanctioned the RSF leader Mohammed Hamdan Dagalo and other senior members of the group. Meanwhile, the victim's trauma continues, says Al-Latif, and for many, it seems to get worse at night.
During the day, they all seem fine, but at night, it's all screaming and chaos in the streets. It's unbelievable.
Although the Darfuris in Adre were lucky enough to escape, they still live with the horror of what happened. Henry Wilkins, VOA News, Adre, Chad.
That'll wrap it up for us today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America.
On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you for joining us.
For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com.
In Washington, I'm Alexis Strobe.
And I'm Steve Karish. Thanks for listening.